I had studied and practiced psychology for about 15 years before going to coach training. And I think I just learned more about psychology this 9 months than I had in the 10 years prior.
You call yourself technologist. Tell me, what does that mean?
My version of technologist is different. I apply behavioral science and computer science to a problem set.
When you decided to write a book on coaching, what was that trigger point for you?
I started my career, I would say, as like turning people into numbers before I learned that I wanted to talk to them. When I went through coach training and I saw differences in my marriage, saw differences in my relationship, I became really excited about the possibility for how the awareness and ability to apply a coaching mindset and coaching skills could transform anyone.
The moment you introduce the term coaching, and especially in the context of technology, people don't accept it.
I still experience what you experience.
What is it in coaching that makes it what it is?
I have a former colleague named Damian Vaughn, who was a professional U.S. NFL football player, first Brazilian NFL player. NFL players, athletes, they have entire surrounds of 10 plus coaches. The more elite you get, the more coaches you have. Because once you're already great, to get an inch better, that's a meaningful inch. That's a hard inch to earn.
Coaching is a remedial tool, or people misread coaching as telling the other person what others should be doing from the experience that they have.
We are small, naked apes. We are way slower than tigers and lions, and we will armor and protect ourselves and, you know, hide the darkest parts of ourselves, not just from each other, but from ourselves. I'm putting that through a filter that I have about my own beliefs, experiences, values, biases. When I talk to my students about this, I always say, welcome to the matrix. Once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the podcast, The Ex-Monk's Drive. This is your host, Gaurav. And today, we have a very special guest accompanying us. Shauna Waters, a wonderful human and award-winning psychologist, who's also an author and a technologist. Wow, it rhymes well. And yes, you've heard me right. A psychologist and a technologist. She innovatively merges behavioral science with computer science to tackle intricate challenges for her clients at the intersection of psychology and technology. So let's get ready. I can't express the excitement I have for this episode. So let's get right in. Hey, Shauna, thank you so much for joining. Such a pleasure having you here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Shauna, I do understand the world is showing interest to move towards coaching. Primarily people who are in the space of leadership, people who are in the space of people management, people who are HR professional.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you call yourself technologist. Tell me, what does that mean when you add the word technologist in front of your name? What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's an identity that I didn't come to easily or readily. Mm-hmm. I think I had probably been working at a technology firm and serving as a technology executive for years before I really identified that way. But it was actually one day where I came across the definition of technology again, and it's really just the application of science to a problem set. And what struck me about that is the inherent bias that we have, where we have associated technology with computer science as the type of science that's being applied. And as a psychologist by training, I apply behavioral science and computer science to a problem set and think about how those things can work together to actually solve a problem. You know, seen through that lens, it felt very authentic to me. As someone who loves an interdisciplinary approach in general and who was finding myself in these spaces. My version of technologist is different, but I think in high demand and relevance to the kinds of solutions that we find ourselves trying to build today.
And why do you think Why do people associate the term technologist with computers? I personally believe that computer is a vehicle to solve something. So how do you look at when you look at technology and technologist?
Yeah.
And especially in the domain of psychology and the behavioral science and the organizational behavior that you work in.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of like a maturation question, right? When things like the internet and computers and all of that became more broadly adopted and popular, and we were starting to see the possibility of how computer science could really, and the tools that computer science can create, can solve and, you know, really shift the world, transform the world in massive and incredible ways. And one of the ways it does that is through automation and scale. So a ton of power in that. And yet what we've found over time is that, you know, it's fallen short of being able to single-handedly resolve a lot of the world's challenges. I read an interview by Satya Nadella, who was actually talking about this and sort of lamenting the promise of the internet for solving democratizing education and things like that in India, for example, as one of the contexts. And then it really didn't quite get there, right? So the story I tell on this, the reason why we fall short is that we're kind of forgetting that even computer science is implemented and consumed by people.
Yeah.
And so the gap is often explainable by the human side of things and by behavioral science. And so I think that there's a movement toward better recognition and incorporation of those disciplines together and how jointly, you know, we might be able to get farther than we have in the past.
Yeah. And Shona, you have worked with technology companies who are trying to democratize, as you mentioned, education in some ways, shape and form. How did this shift happen in your life when you decided to write a book on coaching, the coaching shift? What was that trigger point for you when a technologist thought of writing something on coaching, the mindsets, the skill sets, what happens in the operating system of an individual's brain?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's probably many steps to that point in time, as there often is. But, you know, I started my career, I would say, as like turning people into numbers before I learned that I wanted to talk to them. And I got to that point by really through applied work, implementing measurement systems and selection systems and in a large scale agency, and finding even that was a change management activity. It still involved people and people being the resistance and things like that. And when I went through coach training, what was striking to me is that I didn't have like an immediate need or desire to become a professional coach. I went through it to expand my own skill set and how to incorporate it into my change management work and also how to apply it to myself. But it had a profound impact on me even as a parent, right? I had two small children at the time, and I like to joke that I had my parenting style before coaching and after coaching, and what a shift that caused. And I saw differences in my marriage, and I saw differences in my relationships at work and with my friends and all of that. And so I became really excited about the possibility for how the awareness and ability to apply a coaching mindset and coaching skills could transform anyone and ultimately like have an impact on organizations and give us new ways to solve some of these big societal challenges. So the book came from really a class that I teach at Georgetown University for HR professionals. So not for people who are necessarily ever going to serve in a formal role as a coach, but this opportunity to teach them about the practice of coaching, the science of coaching, and how they can use that as a lens through which they approach everything else in their lives.
I'm going to share with you one of my experiences and would love to hear your views. My experience has been the moment you introduce the term coaching, and especially in the context of technology world that we are working in, the IoT world that we are working in, people don't accept it as is. Rather, there's a lot of resistance that I experience. People feel that, oh, that's not for me. That's for people who are not performing. Coaching is a remedial tool. Or people misread coaching as telling the other person what others should be doing from the experience that they have. What has been your experience? That's one. Second, how do you deal with that? And when you are saying that coaching has helped you to reestablish your relationship with your two children, it has helped you in your marital life. It has helped you the way you look at yourself. So,
yeah. Well, a few things on that. One is I am seeing, you know, over the last 10 years or so that I've been in this world, a shift where I think there's a little bit more, we're talking about it more. People know somebody who's had a coach. I think there's more broad acceptance. And I still experience what you experience. But I'll give you an example. So I have a former colleague at BetterUp named Damian Vaughn, who was a professional U.S. NFL football player, first Brazilian NFL player, I believe. After he retired from the NFL, he had this moment of like going into corporate and being very confused about what he was seeing, where, you know, in football or in most sports, you practice 95% of the time and you perform 5% of the time. And while you're doing that, the more elite you get, the more coaches you have. NFL players, athletes, they have entire surrounds of 10 plus coaches, right? And that is a sign, a signal of status, because to once you're already great, to get an inch better, like that's a meaningful inch. That's a hard inch to earn. And so you really need a lot of support and expertise to help you get even better. When we get into the corporate world, it's completely reversed. We're performing 95% of the time. We're practicing at best 5, and we have very little support, if any, no matter what, you know, stage of expertise we're
in. Very little or no support.
Or no support, right. Yeah. I think the question is, like, what could we as individuals, or, you know, we as corporations achieve if we flipped that paradigm, if we created more space for really like refining our skills, practicing, learning, feedback, getting better, so that when we are performing, we are at the top of our game.
And you mentioned that it has helped you reestablish your relationship with your children, with your partner, with yourself. What aspect of coaching helped you to reestablish that?
Well, probably a lot of aspects. But one thing I'll say about like why I fell in love with coaching was because at the time I went to coach training, you know, I have my PhD in psychology. I had studied and practiced psychology for about 15 years before going to coach training. And going through coach training, I said, wow, I think I just learned more about psychology in, you know, this 9 months than I had in the 10 years prior. Well, why was that? It's such an integrated lens of how all these different psychological theories and principles and, you know, hundreds of years of research come together to really form like how we all work, both as individuals and as social creatures. And so, you know, again, it's in some ways It's not revelation, it's deja vu. Like you've always known it, but you see it in a different way.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was about like, oh yeah, we can be looking at the very same thing and be telling completely different stories about it because all data is going through the selection filter of like, I'm not seeing all the data. I'm seeing some subset of the data. I'm putting that through a filter that I have about my own beliefs, experiences, values, biases, and all of those things too. And then I am not a passive agent in the world. I am interacting with the world and co-creating it at all times.
All the time.
All the time. So when I talk to my students about this, I always say, welcome to the matrix. Like you just like, and once you see it, you can't unsee it. And so as a parent and as a partner, it allows you to start holding things at arm's length, viewing it objectively and saying, where am I in this story? Every problem I've ever had, I've been there, right? So like, how can I start taking more accountability, more ownership. So it starts with the awareness. And then coaching also teaches you better skills on how to listen, how to make clear requests, you know, just clear communication. And that by itself, I think, is something that, you know, children just want to be listened to. So often acting out in emotional regulation is a manifestation of not being seen or heard. Yeah. So much of relational conflict comes down to communication or, you should have known what I wanted when I never told you what that was. I think a lot of those basics that really just can make you a more effective human.
Yeah. And I think it's not only about when you're talking to children. I think in any relationship, people would expect you to understand, even if I've not yet communicated to you. Mm-hmm. And I think that becomes one of the reasons for all the conflicts that we have to deal with, the interpersonal conflicts that we're talking about.
Absolutely.
Shona, what is it in coaching that makes it what it is? When it allows an individual to relook at their relationship itself, it allows them to improve their relationship with others. It allows them to improve their relationship with life and with the world in totality.
Yeah, I mean, so as a scientist, I will say there's a lot that we're just still starting to like unpack and understand about what is the magic of coaching? How do we look at it objectively and, you know, quantify it and all of that stuff? As a practitioner, my belief is that a huge component of it is creating a safe space. So in my book, The Coaching Shift, we talk about the foundation, the first step in becoming more coach-like is mindset. And we characterize a coaching mindset as a new kind of con artist, curious, open, and non-judgmental. Well, why is that so important? Humans are super social creatures. Like we had to be social for our survival as a species. We are small naked apes. We are way slower than tigers and lions and, you know, things like that, right? So we depended on each other for our survival and safety. So the idea of being judged, the idea of being, you know, potentially rejected or ostracized from a group triggers something at a really deep evolutionary level in us. And so we will armor and protect ourselves and, you know, hide the darkest parts of ourselves, not just from each other, but from ourselves, if we feel like that's a risk.
Yeah.
And there's very few places in our lives where it's not, if we're really honest. And so the idea of a coach is really someone who genuinely has your best interests at heart and is here to help you learn and grow and will not judge you no matter what shows up. So I think it's that combined with the space and intentionality We're running around from thing to thing to thing all the time. And the space to pause, create awareness, create intention, and reflect is, I think, a major catalyst to learning. Yeah.
Take a pause, create awareness, create intentions. Yeah. Yeah. And just curious, you know, Shona, you said that you've written this book called The Coaching Shift for HR Professionals.
So how is it different to facilitate a program for HR professionals and training them, teaching them coaching skills than when you are leading a similar program teaching business leaders coaching skills? So what's the difference that you have noticed?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it's funny, the class we teach, we originally developed all the content for HR professionals, and we do deliver it to HR professionals. When we wrote the book, we actually ended up making a shift to a broader audience. And the reason why was because we kept having people approach us who knew about the class and wanted to use it for business leaders and managers and kind of a broader audience. And that's where we realized that the content really has no target audience. It's applicable to everyone. And so when we're working with HR professionals, I think what's different is that they play a lot of different roles in organizations. Frequently, the way that they're employing their coaching skills is one-on-one working with business leaders and, you know, trying to provide advice and support through their people challenges. But another way that HR leaders can leverage it, especially a coaching mindset, is that they often have control or purview over people policies and practices. Things like, what does our performance management system look like? How do we design it? How do I balance, you know, what the organization needs and what the employees need and these, you know, differences in perspective? And that's where, you know, I think there can be a lot of value in saying, like, how does everything change if you start with the assumption that people are creative, resourceful, and whole, that everyone wants to be their best, and that there's multiple perspectives and often not one right answer and all of those things? Like, how does that start to shape the way we even construct policy?
Makes so much sense. And in your experience, Shona, why is it important, and it's getting more and more important for CXOs and leaders at CXO minus one position to understand what is coaching? What does it mean to engage in a dialogue with their team members? What does it mean to listen at the deepest possible level? What does it mean to be curious, open, and ask questions from a space of possibilities?
At this stage in history, I think it's become less of just being about like creating more humane workplaces where people enjoy coming to work and all of that. And I actually think it's a business imperative in terms of the survival of our companies. And that's because there's a ton of complexity. There's really no industry that's not getting disrupted. The capacity to change and grow and evolve is going to be the main competitive advantage. And how do we do that? Well, information is becoming democratized. Even if you just think about things like generative AI, like, it's no longer true that the people at the top of an organization know more than the people on the front lines. They're both closer to the customer and have often access to just as much information as you do. And the world is moving very fast. Expectations are changing from customers, from employees. And so how do we keep pace as an organization? Like, we don't have time for the trickle down that we once depended on. We need people to be trying new things, to be testing, to be innovating, to be bringing multiple perspectives to the fore. And they're not going to do that if they don't trust you. They're not going to do that if they think you don't value their opinion. And you're not going to get that information if you're engaged in one-way dialogue all the time.
Precisely. Precisely. And Shona, you spoke about change, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you talk to any leader, one of the cliched statements people carry with themselves is change is inevitable. Everyone is talking about change. People will tell you change is inevitable. The only constant is change. Every yes. moment you have to change or you will be out of the market. And yet when it comes to change, it's not that easy.
No, it's not.
What do you think? What comes in the way for a leader?
Yeah, well, I really like the work of Bob Keegan and Lisa Leahy on immunity to change. And the reason is they talk about this notion of competing commitments. Mm. So I think that genuinely everyone who says that they know change is important and they have this intention to engage in it and fall short, like I believe them. I believe they have that intention. I believe they care. I believe they want to. And I also believe that they got to where they were by being reinforced for what they've always done. And so to, especially at these heights of you're at the top of your career, you are a CEO, C-level officer, there is a huge amount of risk and a leap of faith to take that doing something different is going to serve you well. And it takes more energy to do something different than it does to keep doing the same thing.
Now, I can so much relate to that because the payoff of not making the change is still more than the cost that you are paying in your mind. And the moment you're able to identify that the cost that I'm paying for not changing is more than the payoff that I'm getting, I'll make a sincere attempt. Now, the challenging part is, as you mentioned about the competing commitments, they're not so visible to an individual. And especially people who are in the CXO position or the CXO minus one position, because they've been doing things for so many years and all the things that they have been doing, the behaviors that they have been practicing on a day-to-day basis, those practices, those behaviors have served them for the longest period of time and helped them reach where they have reached. And taking a risk from that vantage point, I think it's too risky. And not everyone is willing to dip their toe in the water.
Yeah. I like to think of the three major phases of change, right? There's that initiation of change, which is hard in and of itself.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's not just deciding you're going to take that risk yourself, but then you've got to convince other people, maybe it's your board, maybe it's your CXO colleague that this is worthy of taking on. Then you've got to enlist broader support and actually, you know, matriculate the change throughout a broader population of people. And that comes with its own set of challenges, right? And storytelling gets really important and vision and, you know, doing that operational bridge, building it between the vision and like what it actually means, what people need to do differently and all of that. And then there's sustaining the change. And this is where, again, it's like not easy. Like we are working from deep grooves. And so we might have the best of intent to sustain this change, but it's not like it's one thing. It's things coming out all over. So we get distracted. We get pulled back into our old way of being. We slide back into that groove, right? And so how do you keep the attentional resources and while you're building these new muscles and then doing that at the scale of tens of thousands of people potentially in your organization? So it is daunting. It's a lot of work.
It is daunting, And Shona, in between you use this word that there's a tendency in all of us to go back to our old way of being. And what does that mean?
Yeah, so ways of being, you know, it's kind of an esoteric concept, but I like to think of it as like, what have we embodied? What has become so habitual that we don't even think about it? It's just the way that we do something. And, you know, I think the examples of this is like, I used to commute a long way to work, and, you know, I would go at 4:30 in the morning, and sometimes I would end up looking up in the parking lot and being like, no memory of how I got there, right? I didn't remember turning the steering wheel. I didn't remember like changing lanes or, you know, using my blinker, any of that stuff. It's so automatic.
Yeah.
Like, that is the level to which so much of our behavior, you know, probably north of 70% of our daily waking behavior is habitual and embodied.
And would it be a fair assumption to make that when I am operating in my default way of being, then I'm so blind to my being that I can't even see that if it's serving me or it's not serving me?
Yeah. The phrase I always lean on here is the fish can't see the water.
Mm. So in that case, how can I bring awareness in my own self as a leader that this behavior of mine, this way of being is not serving me, when everything around me, everyone around me is only validating the success I'm experiencing and the wave I'm riding onto?
There's a little bit of organizational physics associated with power and position.
Yeah.
And that the higher the level we rise to an organization, the more curated our experiences. And so it becomes harder and harder to get the full picture, right? People are telling you what they think you want to hear. They're validating you. You're, you know, always the smartest person in the room and things like that. And so how do you develop the awareness, right?
That something is not serving me.
That something's not serving you, right?
Yeah.
I do think that this is one of the reasons why, you know, roles like coaches are more heavily used in senior levels, one of the many reasons. But I also think there's other ways, right? I think that, you know, I know a number of successful leaders who create their own personal accountability boards, right? So who are the people throughout their life who will tell them the ugly truth, even when they think they don't want to hear it? You know, how do you set up these? And some people use their spouses, or like, who will tell you when your outfit doesn't look good, the way you're coming across isn't landing well, you know, all of that. And I think there's a space also for mature leaders to develop a practice of, you know, when something isn't going well around me, like, where am I in that story? What could it be? What am I doing? How do I incorporate, you know, mechanisms for feedback and self-reflection, like as a discipline?
I'm just listening to you. It reminds me of a story of a king who is walking in his kingdom without clothes. Mm-hmm. And he just requires one small child to tell him that, hey, king, you're not wearing your clothes. And one, as a leader, do I have what is required to create the psychological safety in the environment that I'm leading? That's one. Second, am I taking enough and regular pauses to reflect on what's working, what might not be working, and how my default way of being is coming in my own way? Or, as you mentioned, do I have someone that I can connect with, I can speak to, who can give me a candid feedback that might assist me to revisit my way of being?
And I think even the clarity of the intention around how do you want to show up, like, what do you want your impact on other people and on your organization to be? Michael Bungay Stanier's work, we use that in our class. I reference him in the book, but he has a practice of this, not that. So developing a simple table or framework on, like, when I am my best self, I show up like this, not like that. Mm. It's like a simple rubric, right? Mm. But once you have like clarity and conviction around what good looks like to you, how do you set up the mechanisms to know if you're hitting that or not?
What would I be doing? What I would not be doing? Who exactly. would I be and who wouldn't I be?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And in your experience, Shona, having worked with different leaders across the industries, across the world, do you see a difference in terms of where the leader is coming from, any particular geography that he's coming from? Does that have an impact on him? Is there any gender biases have you observed that you have observed? Any specific conclusion that you are coming to, a partial conclusion that you're coming up with that impacts the way you show up as a coach in a conversation?
Yeah, it's a great question. The way that I would answer that is probably yes. I see a lot of differences. I think culture has such big implications for how we view the world and what norms and everything. And yet, I think we all come with individual stories and lenses that layer onto these things as well. In terms of gender, what I'm finding is that what society is calling for today is a more balanced approach that better weaves together like masculine and feminine styles and principles. And what I mean by that is I think an industrial era context and organizations really favored efficiency, hierarchy, competition, scarcity, things like that. And the complexity of the world today and the pace that things are moving and, you know, changing societal expectations really require more collaboration and community and abundance. I think connection, nurturing, like things that I think are more historically feminine approaches. And so what I see is a lot of female leaders who I work with are trying to learn how to influence more in, you know, more assertively or aggressively to get those perspectives heard. Yeah. And the male leaders who I work with are trying to figure out how to build connection and collaboration and all of that on their teams in ways that really require the other.
As we are talking, a word which is coming to me is a growth dialogue or a growth partner. Mm-hmm. What, according to you, are the ways that could help an individual, that could help a leader to grow and become a growth partner for their team members, for their counterparts, for their colleagues, for their seniors as well, being a 360-degree growth partner?
I think where it starts is that for me to see you as a growth partner, or for me to be willing to get vulnerable, listen to what you have to say, your perspectives or whatever, I have to believe that you have my best interest at heart. If that's in question, I think there's a natural barrier, like there's a wall that goes up. So I think it starts with
the intention part of it.
Yeah, the intention. And I like to use this as a visual even for, you know, people talk about like difficult conversations or crucial conversations.
Crucial conversations, like yeah.
And I bristle a little bit even at that label, because as soon as you have in your mind, I have to have a difficult conversation or a crucial conversation, it brings up all this, like, I don't want to do that. Who wants to do that? Right.
And you get your armor in the game.
Yeah. You get your armor and you start to visualize yourself in opposition to the other person. Right. So if I say the word, like, I'm going to ask you to have a feedback conversation, what's the image that comes to mind? Usually immediately we're standing across from someone, right?
Yeah. And there's contraction. There is heaviness in my body.
Yeah. You feel it in your body.
Close myself. Yeah.
Yes. Now, what if I said, okay, I want you to have this conversation and you're going to be standing next to the person. You're walking down a path together. Visualize that going in. What does that feel like?
Yeah, as I'm just listening to you, this is like going for a trek together in the beautiful mountains surrounded by green trees. I can listen to the stream of water and this lightness and breeze all around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so you go from this like threat state where your perspective is narrowing and you're armoring for survival, right? To a much more open, expansive, I can now see more, I can hear more, right? And so I think that's the starting point. It's like, how do we show up as growth partners for each other? Mm. Well, it starts with how do we even think of like our role and our relationship, you know, how we're in relation to each other. And am I here to advise you, inform you, like as your, as someone who knows more than you, or are we here to walk down this path together where, you know, I'm going to share information, you're going to share information, we're going to go co-create what's next. And whatever that looks like for you, I'm here to support.
Precisely. And as you said, that human beings are wired for connection.
Yes.
And in case of lack of psychological safety or in case of any threat, we get rewired for protection. Now, it's absolutely in the hand of a growth partner. It's absolutely in the hand of a leader. What kind of environment, what kind of space am I creating for my team members, for my colleagues, for my seniors, that they would be comfortable to walk with me on this beautiful path and listen to the water streams and enjoy the breeze? Or I could create another environment where people would be carrying their armors and the weapons.
Yes. So,
thank you, Shona. I think it was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful conversation. Thank you for being so generous and open and exploring all these beautiful pieces and knitting them together so well. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. It's an honor and privilege to talk to you today.
Thank you for tuning in to this captivating installment of the X Monks Drive podcast. We were honored to have Shona Waters, an exceptional individual blending the realms of psychology, technology, and literature, as our esteemed guest today. I hope you found this episode as enlightening as I did. Please do share that with your family and friends who you believe would get benefited out of this conversation. And please take some time to rate and review this podcast on your favorite podcast channel, be it Spotify or Apple. And also take some time to follow us on YouTube. Stay tuned for more insightful discussions and engaging guests in future episodes. And I look forward to meeting you next week with yet another interesting, thought-provoking conversation. Till then, take care of yourself. Stay blessed.